gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. Number here, 1-800-STEPH-12. Of course, StephanieMiller.com for all the pertinent information. Of course, the vacation cam, which is there, which is the Mooks were nice enough to mount cameras on their foreheads all during their vacation so we can see exactly what they're seeing. I'm, of course, kidding. No one sane would do that. That's crazy. If you knew where they were, it wouldn't be a vacation. We have a ton to talk about today. There is no way I'm going to be able to fit all of this into the simple 3 hours today. This is just the whole world is a boil, and we are going to lance it as quickly as we can. But by God, between Michael Jackson, Iran, Honduras, the healthcare debate, and of course the climate change bill that passed on Friday, squeaked by on Friday, we are going to have a lot to deal with. But right off the bat, of course, still very big in the news is Michael Jackson. The 911 phone call has been released. It's, you know, the interesting thing is that this has become sort of common practice is to release a 911 phone call after something horrible happens. And I don't know what kind of window it gives us on life. I mean, these moments in life are never comfortable. They are never smooth. They never go the way people think they should go. Everybody's doing the best they can in a circumstance, and that's pretty much all you can ever hear in those calls. But many people want to know, and so we've got it broken up a little bit. Let me hear the first part of it.
Sir, we have a gentleman here that needs help, and he's not breathing yet. He's not breathing, and we're trying to pump him, but he's not breathing, sir.
Okay, how old is he?
He's 50 years old, sir.
50, okay. He's unconscious, he's not breathing?
Yes, he's not breathing, sir.
Okay, and he's not conscious either?
He's not conscious, sir.
Okay.
Okay. By this time, they know his address, and they are coming for him. The 911 operator is just trying to talk them through, as they do every time someone makes a call like this, and try to assess the situation. At this point, Michael Jackson is actually laying on the bed, as we understand it, his doctor was trying to, over the weekend, his doctor was trying to administer CPR by pushing on his body, literally rolling him up and shoving on his back and his chest, because the bed was too soft for compression. And in the second part of the call, you can kind of hear where they reference moving him to the floor.
All right. Do you have him? Is he on the floor? Where is he at right now?
He's on the bed, sir. He's on the bed.
Okay, let's get him on the floor.
Okay.
Okay, let's get him down to the floor. I'm going to help you with CPR right now, okay?
We need him. We need him.
We're already on our way there. We're on our way. I'm going to do as much as I can to help you over the phone. We're already on our way. Did anybody see him?
Yes, we have a personal doctor here with him, sir.
Oh, you have a doctor there?
Yes, but he's not responding to anything. No, he's not responding to CPR or anything, sir.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so and then in the next segment, the 911 operator is actually saying that since there's a physician on site, he sort of outranks him as far as medical advice. He can't give any better medical advice than a medical doctor who's on scene, and therefore he just basically begs off the call, says that the EMTs are coming. There's not much more he can do from there, but if they have any other questions in the interim, please, call back. So here's the rest of the call.
Well, we're on our way there. If your guys are doing CPR, you're instructed by a doctor, he has a higher authority than me, and he's there on scene.
Okay.
Did anybody witness what happened?
No, just the doctor, sir. The doctor's been the only one here.
Okay, so did the doctor see what happened?
Doctor, did you see what happened, sir? Sir, you just... if you can please.
We're on our way. We're on our way. I'm just passing these questions on to my paramedics while they're on the way there, sir.
Thank you, sir. He's pumping his chest, but he's not responding to anything, sir. Please.
Okay. We're on our way. We're less than a mile away. We'll be there shortly.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Okay, sir. Call us back if you need any help. Right. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Now, I've actually performed CPR on someone when they went down, and I've waited for paramedics while I've been doing mouth-to-mouth and CPR. And you can see, there's an increased desperation that occurs over the time when you're really trying to revive someone. I was lucky enough that the person I was trying to revive at the time actually started breathing again on their own after mouth-to-mouth. But it was a very – it's just a shock to your system. And you can really hear that in the voice of his friend there who's calling in. The questionable part, and this is the part that's worrying everyone, is that you know, he even said the doctor was the only one on site. The doctor was the only one around him. He was the one who found him. The details are coming out that supposedly he did have a pulse before he went to the hospital, but the family ordered a second autopsy. There's just a lot of questions about this, and I think the question of Demerol and usage and the OxyContin usage is going to be paramount when the toxicology reports come out in the next 6 weeks. It's just fascinating. Meanwhile, it didn't take long for those affected by it to release a tribute song. There's actually one featuring Diddy and Chris Brown. Here's an excerpt from that song. I think there's an excerpt. It's all right, Tony. It's our first day. You could relax, man. It's all right.
Michael Jackson, I'm Michael Jackson, we all Michael Jackson. I guess what I'm asking is everybody bow their head for a legend. Don't breathe for a second, now let the air out. Grab a hand of somebody you care about, so you can hear my message, my confession. Somebody tell Usher, I seen a moonwalk. I guess the young Thriller touched him, like he touched me, like he touched you. So carrying his legacy, something I must do. And I trust you, lighting candles, concrete vigils. Me and my brother, Mr. Jackson 5, in our living room. First thing I did when I heard was called Puff, cause him and Mike try to stop the beat between us. Who is us, me and 50? That beat is dead, him and young Mike Jackson gonna take us to the ledge.
So, you know, obviously, this is an interesting thing, too, because I was listening to Johnny Wendell this weekend, and he was actually making the point that Michael Jackson wasn't actually as influential a musician as people make him out to be. And he was saying that sort of in the negative sense. I think, personally, that Michael Jackson had an impulse, had an impact on people that made them want to be in the music business. I think Justin Timberlake, you can trace as much of his music to Prince as you can to Michael Jackson, other than his singing style. But what he did was invigorate the idea that this is what I want to do. He made you want to dance. He made you want to sing. And that was really the effect that he had. And clearly, the song kind of, I don't know, degrades into a phone tree after a while. A guy called P. Diddy, and then Chris Brown called me. And then at one point I hung up and we were three-way calling. And, you know, how fast? I mean, how great a song can you expect that quickly, honestly? I mean, you know, come on. But you can obviously feel the emotion in it for a lot of those folks. And the reverberations of his death obviously have reached far and wide. I actually saw a quote on the a headline this weekend that said the death of Michael Jackson might have doomed Iran because it drew so much attention from it, and it also kind of sucked the wind out of people for a little bit. They, you know, it was a bit of a shock. And I even said that, you know, I actually believe that if you went to – he had such a wide appeal and wide – people had such wide respect for him all over the world that if you actually went to Iran, you'd probably see someone who's being treated for a bullet wound with, you know, holding a bloody rag to their face, and someone said, you know, Michael Jackson just died. They would have gone, oh, crap, really? That's terrible, in Farsi, but still. You know, he had a huge, huge reach. And here's the White House press corps reacting to the death of Michael Jackson.
In May of 1984, then-President Ronald Reagan hosted Michael Jackson here at the White House. It was a madhouse. Everybody in town wanted to be there.
I can't remember what was said, but I know that everybody wanted to be out there more than a head of state or king or prime minister that you get. They became the usual.
Ronald Reagan said he hadn't seen so many people in one place since he left China. And he began his remarks by saying, well, I know
always
this
sensitive.
Is a thriller.
Everybody was practically almost imitating his movements.
Wow, that I would have paid to see. Helen Thomas doing the moonwalk or the backslide, as it's really known. Most people confuse the move, the moonwalk. It is not officially named the moonwalk. It is the backslide. The moonwalk is a totally different move where your arms are kind of elevated and your feet are sliding back and forth as if you're walking on the moon. A lot of break dancers do it. The backslide is what Michael Jackson was famous for. People called it the moonwalk, but you could never, of course, walk on the moon doing that because it's covered in gravel and you would fall down and bust your spacesuit and then air would seep in and your head would explode. So I think clearly not the moonwalk is the backslide. We can settle that once and for all. Was Helen Thomas actually wearing the white glove for a little while? I think she was. I think it would have been a good look for her. By the way, this is the Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEPH-12. This is Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. You can go to stephaniemiller.com, and we will be doing our best to fill in the void created by the need for rest by Stephanie Miller and the Mooks. I think it's good that they've all gone to the Bahamas together. They don't have enough time together in the studio, so they're all just there sipping my... I'm kidding. I have no idea where they are, and I think that's probably best. now, on to quote-unquote real news. We have in our next segment, Lawrence Korb, the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, is going to be coming on to talk to us about Iran. There's a lot going on there. Fareed Zakaria even said over the weekend that he refused to come out and fully say that it was a coup, but it looks like the Revolutionary Guard may be pushing for total control over the country and pushing for a border, a closer secular line there. It's going to be touch and go. It's apparently what Ahmadinejad has wanted all along. It in some ways puts us in a more precarious position as a country. But interestingly enough, this idea somehow that that Iran is one of the axis of evil and that it is this dark force in the universe and that we must hate them and they obviously hate us has been proven to be a complete negative, is baloney, horse hockey, as they would say, because of all the Iranian people we have seen in the streets fighting for their own personal freedoms. And you have to think every time, the next time you hear a neocon or a nudnik come out and say, we need to, bomb Iran. There was some politician last year who said that. Who was that? I can't remember. Anyways, I'll remember later. He sang it, I even think. Who was that guy? Oh, yeah. Anyways, that has ended forever. Now it is, I'm kidding, I know it's McCain. It's so sweet. Rebecca Baker just typed in McCain just to make sure that I knew. I was being ironic. It's not a completely sarcasm-free zone while I'm here. You don't have to worry. but yes, so we had this idea that they were the axis of evil, that they were somehow this dark force. Even North Korea, with the vision we always see of North Korea, all we ever see of North Korea is marching soldiers. This is the only footage we have, is tanks, marching soldiers, and empty missile casings that look really scary. And the same thing was true of Iran for a while, until the protests. And there are more protests going on. There are people are now back to yelling Allah Akbar out their window, which, is, praise be to God, but has also become a rallying cry for them. So this is really fascinating. I think a lot of people were affected by the fact that they're watching these protesters running down the street, and half the people watching are going, wow, those are some nice jeans they have on. Those people are incredibly stylish. I mean, they all look like most of the protesters you see look like they're running out of an Abercrombie and Finch ad. They've got these nice V-neck sweaters, really high density cloth. They're wearing, nice designer jeans. And you're like, they really do love the West. We always heard that as a rumor, but it is true. And we have a lot more in common as a people with them than we were made to believe. And I think that's probably the healthiest thing that's come out of there, is now we as a public are now permanently changed in the fact that we can't just every time we envision Iran and our policy towards Iran, we only pictured Ahmadinejad standing there like Hitler, kind of banging his fist on a lame-looking podium in front of, 1,000 like-minded followers. And now that we know that the country is not just full of robots who believe that crap, hopefully that will drive us to a more balanced perspective. So we have in the second... In the second segment of today, we have Lawrence Korb. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's going to be with us, and hopefully will help us straighten some of this out, because, quite frankly, there are a lot of new details over the weekend, and it doesn't look like it's stopping. The big thing was, will it stop within 5 days? If it stops within 5 days, that's what we'd been dealing with before. So, anyways, we have that coming up. And I'm looking forward to talking to him. We also have to deal with the climate change bill. It's now passed the House, but it's going to the Senate, and now everybody's saying it's going to be shot down in the Senate because it will cost jobs and be expensive. You don't think oil is costing jobs and is expensive? You don't think the future of oil is going to cost us jobs and be expensive? It's time to catch up with the current technology and actually try to be people living in 2009. It would be a thought, anyways, instead of 1950. This is Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller while the Mooks and she are away. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. Call in if you feel like it. StephanieMiller.com. This is The Stephanie Miller Show.
It's a combination of low self-esteem, low blood sugar, and mixing red wine with my dog's painkillers.
It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller while she's on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number, and StephanieMiller.com. Okay, so we're going to deal in the next segments about Iran. It's reached a very touch and go level. This weekend, Ahmadinejad came out and attacked Obama. He mocked even Obama's change mantra. He said, "You should know that if you continue, the response of the Iranian nation will be strong." He said, "The response of the Iranian nation will be crushing. The response will cause remorse." Of course, it will. Talking to him always causes remorse. The interesting thing is, now that the protesters have had a chance to voice their disagreement with their government, and because that voice has reached the entire world, you now have a change of attitude towards that country and, of course, about that country. Anytime Ahmadinejad now says, the Iranian nation says this, he can no longer say that with the strength that he said it even 6 months ago. That's the fundamental change that we will be dealing with. Now the question is, does that mean he cracks down harder? Does that mean it makes it harder for those people that he has taken away? There's many of the people have been detained. A lot of college professors, a lot of demonstrators are being tracked down. The Basij are now acting out, which is a paramilitary group, acting out as an arm of the government. Will this be a permanent shutdown? Apparently, there's fear that we will only have maybe we'll have another 4 to 6 months before we will be able to engage with Iran at all. So that's the touchy part. We will be discussing more of this with Lawrence Korb after the break, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Hopefully he can give us a window on the reality on the ground and what America's options are in this situation. We'll be back. This is the Stephanie Miller Show.
Somehow death loses its sting.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. This is Hal Sparks filling in for Stephanie while she's on vacation. I've made it through my first half hour. I think that's a great milestone, sitting in here by my lonesome. Of course, I have Tony operating the board, but he is legally not allowed to speak to the public. They've given him a set of earphones so he can hear the show, but he is not allowed to speak in any way. I don't know if the duct tape was necessary, but is that the... is that the studio's choice? Did they make you wear the... just... well, don't argue with me. Just wear the... if it's for personal use, just it should be for personal use. I'm just saying, do what you like. but here we are. In this block, we're going to be talking to Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, about Iran, which personally I think should be spelled with an L and a D, Iran, because that's really how it's pronounced. When are we going to grow up as a culture and start writing out the names of countries in the way that they actually sound when we say them? I mean, I know it's a nitpicky issue, but it's not pronounced Iran. Iraq wasn't even pronounced Iraq. It's Iraq. So what, there's a D and an L in there somewhere. I don't know. There might be a clock in there involved. It's hard to say. I'm just saying that, you know, a matter of...
A chat with you and somehow death loses its sting.
Okay, all right. I'll let it go. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. StephanieMiller.com. Don't forget to go there. Now, Ahmadinejad, actually. Mm-hmm. Was being as threatening. He was back to his old threatening self. I guess he'd come back from Russia, his little trip up there to negotiate oil rights or whatnot, security details. And he's now referencing, he's now taking a much harder line. And it gets kind of spooky because it seems as if there are still protests going on. Every time they get a chance, the protesters are out there, and yet the Basij and Ahmadinejad and the forces of the Republican Guard there are coming down harder on them as we go along. It's a very tenuous situation. And then over the weekend, we find out, of course, that the president of Manuel Zelaya of Honduras was deposed by soldiers. He was actually grabbed in his pajamas in the middle of the night and flown, I think, to Costa Rica and dropped off, where he held a press conference immediately in whatever clothes he bought at the airport gift shop, I think. That's the amazing thing I love about airport gift shops, actually, is the fact that you can really disappear. They sell everything, you know. Just get some tan shorts, a weird V-neck golf shirt, some new socks. Your identity has changed. You can just vanish into the... That's the other thing I love about CVS. You can recreate your world just from there. You can start over from scratch if you go to one of these places. So, Zelaya was arrested by paramilitary groups, awakened by gunfire Sunday night, detained in his pajamas before a constitutional referendum was passed that gave power away. The Speaker of the House, I believe, became president. That's it. And he's now saying, of course, that and supposedly he signed some sort of a document handing over control of the country, that he was stepping down, he was resigning, and he says, of course, that was faked because he would never sign a document of such importance in his pajamas. I don't think I would. At least my dress pajamas. I would want to wear my nice pajamas. If I could, if I was signing one of those things, if I was giving away everything that I had cooed from a country, I would want to wear my shirt and tie, not my pajamas, before I was dropped off in Costa Rica in my pajamas to argue that this was not a national referendum. Let's say that. So his successor, I don't know what you want to actually call him. Congressional leader Roberto Micheletti was sworn in to serve until January 27th when Zelaya's term ends. Micheletti belongs to Zelaya's Liberal Party but opposed the president in the referendum. My slogan will be the reconciliation of the grand family of Hondurans and a grand national dialogue, Micheletti said, after the Congress gave the military a long-standing ovation. So obviously they're big fans of the word grand, and grand really carries a lot of weight. So we'll see if... You know, Honduras has always been an iffy part of the world. It's always, you know, it's sort of off our radar these days. And I don't know that it will necessarily bring it back onto our radar, per se. It's almost cute compared to the other problems we have in the world. I'm sure there's somebody who's going to call up and go, do you realize how much corn we get from Honduras? Or what, you know, I'm a big fan. The company Frito-Lay's Doritos are actually made specifically in Honduras. We're going to find out one little detail. If it wasn't for Honduras, we wouldn't have shoestrings. And then there's going to be this, oh, now we'll all suddenly care a lot about Manuel Zelaya and whether or not he deserves to be in office. but Iran, obviously a bigger fish fry. And then, of course, North Korea. Interestingly enough, everything seems to be working towards knocking North Korea off of our radar as far as the national dialogue, as far as conversation. It's a very, very serious issue. Oh, we actually have a caller, though, and this is an interesting issue I would like to touch on. I know it's kind of off subject, but I would like to talk to this. This is Gene in Madison, Wisconsin, which is a very good point of today. Hold on. Gene, you there?
Hey, Gene. How are you? Yeah, this is Gene.
You are Gene. I'm Hal, and I'm filling in for Stephanie, and you are Gene. And
yes.
Settled that.
Hal, I wanted to talk just a minute about the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots.
Absolutely.
In Greenwich Village. And I hope all of your listeners today know that you played an important part in sort of cultural history around gay rights with the groundbreaking show Queer as Folk.
Well, thank you.
And I really want to thank you. I think that that whole series did a lot to just sort of broaden public consciousness about the everyday lives of gays and lesbians. And I think it's important today that we all keep pushing the Obama administration, and I'm glad that there are a series of meetings coming up, especially one today in the White House.
Absolutely.
Where the president is going to be meeting with leaders of various gay rights organizations, but everybody out there ought to keep the pressure up.
I agree. I think that's part of Obama's plan. I've said that all along. I think that he wants people to keep the pressure on, and if he came in and just said, I'm going to overturn Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and I'm not going to enforce DOMA, then it would stay on the books, and then if a Republican got in next time, they would just kick it into high gear again. It has to be handled on the legislative level. You have to contact your congressperson and your senators. There is no middle ground. You can't just say, well, we voted for Obama, he should just sweep it away. It's
right.
Not going to work that way. So I think you're great. I appreciate the call, Gene. And Lawrence Korb is actually with us. So I'm going to let you go. Thanks a ton. And
thank you to Hal for all your good work.
Absolutely. Cheers. So on the line, we have Lawrence Korb from the Center for American Progress. Are you there, Lawrence?
I sure am.
Terrific. Good to talk to you, sir.
Nice to talk to you, Hal.
You know, this is a lot. I mean, every time you think the news is over about Iran, we're always wrong. You know, all last week during the beginning of the demonstrations, everything I heard was, well, we'll see if it lasts longer than 6 days. If it doesn't last longer than, it's done. Things like this have happened before, and they always end up sort of dead in the water. And now it's really, reaching into a different thing. Over the weekend, Fareed Zakaria mentioned that there may have been a coup by the military, you could call it a coup, but maybe you can explain it a little better than I can.
Yeah, I think what Fareed was saying was the following, that what may have happened is the Revolutionary Guard or their elite military may be calling the shots behind the scenes, that they're the ones basically telling, the Ayatollah to crack down
So he's following their lead.
They would.
So he's following their lead now, because we've always heard, of course, that Khamenei was always the real voice behind Iran, that Ahmadinejad was largely a mouthpiece, but he was actually following what he was being told by the clerics. And he used to be a leader in the Republican Guard. Is that not true?
Well, he wasn't a leader, but he was in this Republic. Some people call it the Revolutionary Guard.
Revolutionary Guard. Right.
He joined. See, what happened, and I think this is important to put it into context. Ahmadinejad was not part of the revolution in 1979 that restored the clerics.
Right.
But he is one of this next generation who wants to keep that spirit alive, and it's the Revolutionary Guard that's really pushing it, where even a lot of the clerics, about one third of the clerics basically have said, it's time to move on. And that's really what the struggle is. The Revolutionary Guard does not want to give up this, if you will, the spirit of the revolution.
Well,
and Ahmadinejad, right, since he came into office, has basically been making common cause with them.
Right. Well, it's certainly, we worried about this in our own country with Bush, is that once you have that kind of power, do you really ever want to give it up?
Well, yeah, and I think that Ahmadinejad, while he really wasn't making, foreign policy, was slowly ingratiating himself with the Revolutionary Guard. And I think that the Revolutionary Guard basically is afraid that the clerics have gone soft, and want to make agreements with the United States. I mean, people forget that after the attacks of September 11th, the Iranian government condemned those attacks. And this is before,
right,
Ahmad Ahmadinejad was there. They were very cooperative with us in Afghanistan. In fact, Bush's envoy at the Bonn Conference, which put Karzai in power back in 2001, said without the Iranians, it wouldn't have succeeded. And what happened was then when the United States then put them on the axis of evil, the Revolutionary Guard said, okay, here it is. Let's go. We're going all out against these guys.
Right, or gave them the ammunition they needed to create a stronger military presence and a military sort of a nationalist ideal.
Right,
they didn't really have that before.
No, they did not, and they were afraid with the 70% of the people in the country being under 30, and them having access through all these
the internet
and Twitter to what's going on in the rest of the world, that they're going to lose their fervor and become globalized or westernized.
Right. Well, and has again, I've been wondering what will actually happen when the internet is in effect turned back on in Iran. I don't think that they're doing without right now. For the large part, they've got blockages all over.
Well, they do, but it's not as successful as they'd like. But the new technologies, they're not able to do it. They can communicate via third parties, and of course, we all know what
proxy
happened
servers.
With Twitter.
Right. Well, and a lot of computer nerds all over the world are actually helping them out by sending them, proxy server software and ways to get around it.
Mm-hmm.
Even hacking into the Iranian system and turning parts of it back on, which was really fascinating. And that's really, I think that spooked some of our cybersecurity experts here in the United States, because we'd always heard under the Patriot Act that was one of the things we had to fear was what if they shut down the internet?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness, And now we've seen what actually does happen in a country where they try that. Well, the internet's a little bit bigger than countries now, in a lot of ways.
It is, yeah.
It's hard to prognosticate, obviously, in this circumstance, but where do you see this going? I happen to think that, this is going to be a toss back and forth over the next 2 years.
I think that's the key. I mean, whatever happens, it's a significant change in Iran. And the question really becomes, do you have the hardliners, take over, or do they continue, moderating or becoming more westernized? I think that there's no way that they can, in the long term, keep that situation under control. I mean, no historical analogy is perfect, but I think it's sort of the beginning of the end for, this tyrannical regime in Iran.
Right. And a lot of times when that happens, that's when the hardest squeeze comes.
Right.
People really try to put it down hard because they see the end. They know that they're on the losing side in that regard. So it's going to be fascinating, but I think over the next 2 years, we're going to see a lot of activity in Iran, even beyond its own relationship to the United States. Its relationship to itself.
Well, and the key thing for us and for the rest of the world, they're going to lose their influence, which they were gaining in what we might call the greater Middle East, because after we got rid of their main enemy in Iraq, and they were able to expand their power and influence, and a lot of young Muslims look to them as the way, as the wave of the future. But now that they've seen what these people have done, they say, this is not what we want.
Right. Well, and also, if you really look at it, it seems like the direction of the Middle East is more in the direction of the UAE and Dubai. When let on its own, that seems to be the direction it goes. Now, obviously, there's been a lot of, monkeying around in that area from a lot of different countries to, Dubai is now, basically Vegas of the world, but there is this kind of appeal to it, certainly. The freedom of it, the non-hardline aspect. We got to take a break, but I want to, and you can stay through the next break with you because there's a lot to talk about here.
Right, sure.
Terrific. This is the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. We're filling in. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. StephanieMiller.com. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in while Steph and the Mooks are on vacation. We'll see you right after the break.
It's a combination of low self-esteem, low blood sugar, and mixing red wine with my dog's painkillers.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
As long as you live. dickheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, dickheads. They all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks filling in for Steph while she's out of town. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. StephanieMiller.com. On the line, still with us, thankfully, is Lawrence Korb. There's so much to talk about on an international front, Lawrence. Obviously, what's going on in Iran has a huge effect, by the way. Are you there? There you go.
I sure am.
That's all right. It's morning, get your coffee, enjoy. It's totally fine. What's going on in Iran is directly reflected by what's going on in Iraq. And is it, am I getting this right? Tomorrow, do we start handing over power back to the Iraqi forces?
Well, starting tomorrow, we have to withdraw all of our combat forces from the cities. And we can only conduct military operations in coordination with them, with the permission of the Iraqis. This was something the Iraqis insisted on when they did the status of forces agreement.
Right.
It was opposed by the Bush administration, but basically Maliki recognizes that as long as he's the prime minister there, as long as he's seen as, if you will, a stooge of the United States, he's not going to get reelected, and so he's insisted on this. And come tomorrow, it goes into effect.
Wow, that's amazing. It kind of snuck up on us. I don't think people are even aware.
No, they weren't. Everybody focused on the fact that we could stay for 3 years. We have to be out of the country completely, but most people missed this 30 June, and I remember when it was signed, I said, that's a significant thing.
Yeah.
Because that's where the violence is, in the cities, and basically the Iraqis are now sovereign, and if there's a disturbance and we want to deal with it, and they say, no, we can't. And in a way, it's a good thing, because what the United States does not want to do is if Maliki calls us out to put down a problem caused by some of his political rivals, we're in a sense, interfering in their political process.
Absolutely. I don't think people were even aware, I haven't even seen that much about it in the news.
Well, unfortunately, what's happened, even though we have 131,000 troops there, it's Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran have captured the news. I know when I went to Pakistan from the 20th to the 30th of April, that's all the news was Pakistan, because at that time the Taliban had broken out of their frontier areas, and, that pushed everything off. Now Iran has pushed everything off the page, and then I think, unfortunately, then Michael Jackson pushed everything off the page, and so people are, it's hard to even get news on Iran these days.
Yeah, well, and North Korea, who?
Yes, yeah.
Just early last week, they had missile parts headed for there, and we had a ship, and it was going to be the biggest, thing since the Cold War,
versus
the Russians with two subs parked up against each other, at a big face-off in the high seas. And now, what? Who cares?
The Chinese have been talking about, using the dollar as the key currency anymore, mm-hmm. and that obviously is very, very critical, because they've got close to $1 trillion of our debt.
Right, and I think the only reason, in many ways, that maybe that's part of what's saving us, is the fact that if they devalue what they, what we have as far as worth.
They're worried that the dollar will be devalued, and the money that they're holding will lose value because of the size of our deficit. So, there's a lot of things going on in the world, and of course we have our horrible economic situation here at home, so it's really hard for people and President Obama to focus on all these issues. He's got climate change. He's got a health care bill. And I noticed your previous guest was talking about things like
Don't Ask, Don't Tell,
Marriage Act.
Absolutely,
Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Yeah.
Well, he was definitely left a pile of rubble to sift through. That's certainly true.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Lawrence Korb, for being with us today, helping us sort this out. If you think Obama has a lot of work to do, I can't imagine what you're doing over there.
Well, thank you very much.
You're doing the heavy lifting as far as understanding all this policy, and I thank you for helping us understand it a little clearer.
Anytime.
Cheers. Lawrence Korb from the Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. This is the Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEPH-12.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
You figured, oh, you're the loser, you know, a deadbeat.
Well, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation, which I hope they're enjoying it. I'm sure Chris Lavoie is at home listening to the show, cringing and concerned that I might be killing his baby while he's away. I want you to, Chris, just wherever you're going, just relax. Everything will be fine. I will, by the end of today, I will have worked everything out. I've even got my own board of, you know, weird little sound effects that I brought in myself.
Lord loves the working man. Don't trust Whitey. See a doctor and get rid of it.
And I think they will fit in very well with the vernacular, you know, that I'm going to be using, my whole thing. I even have some that are specially built for certain politicians.
She turned me into a newt. A newt. It got better.
And I think it's going to go very smoothly. I think once we work all the kinks out, it will be fantastic, especially this hour, because we have Liz Garbus, who's going to be our guest. She's going to be talking about the new documentary on HBO, Shouting Fire, Stories from the Edge of Free Speech. And she's actually with us on the line right now. Liz, are you there?
I'm there.
Fantastic.
I'm
here. You can be wherever you want. You can be here, there. I prefer you here. There, I said it.
Or everywhere.
Yes. This is a fascinating topic, and you know, free speech is one of those things that we all, A, take for granted, and on the other hand, also think that we have the right to take away from nearly anyone. You know, one of my favorite things about Bill O'Reilly lately, because he's adorable, is his whole thing that he thinks it's a violation of his right, free speech, if he's criticized for saying what he says. He thinks that's the same thing.
Right. Well, you know, in our film, you know, Eric Foner, who's one of the interviewers, says, you know, people in this country have this crazy idea that if they don't agree with somebody, they should kill them.
Right.
You know, it's like it's this idea that, you know, mm-hmm. I don't want to be offended. You know, don't offend me. Free speech is free as long as it's not offensive. And,
right.
You know, unfortunately, we don't have the right to not be offended. You know, free speech can be a bummer because a lot of the times you have to be facing views that you really don't like.
I totally agree. And I think Larry Flint said much the same thing, only not as pretty and nice as you said it.
When he said it,
it sounded like free speech is something that we all have a right to.
You do a very good Larry Flint.
Thank you. I actually have him right here in the studio.
Oh, that was actually him. Amazing.
I wheel him around with me wherever I go because I just like his charm. But you cover both sides, as it were. I happen to think, by the way, just from my own perspective, that there's more than both sides of everything. There's multiple sides.
Right.
This is, you know, a polyagonal, as it were.
Absolutely.
But in dealing with sort of the right and the left idea, you have a story of a kid, for example, who was kicked out of school for wearing a shirt that said it was supposedly a Bible-quoting shirt. Right.
Right, that said homosexuality is shameful. He felt that his school, they had a lesbian, gay, LGBT day of silence, so that he thought there should be a day where he could express his political views about homosexuality. So he wore this T-shirt into school.
Right.
And the administration said, you know, you either have to take that T-shirt off or change your T-shirt, or you have to leave. And, you know, sometimes you have to be confronted with ideas that you don't like. Of course, high schools are unique places, right?
Right.
Where learning is supposed to go on, and but at the same time, let the kids learn. It's high school. Let the kids learn by talking back, and let the kids learn by getting into a heated debate, and let the teachers, you know, foster that conversation in a safe environment.
Right.
It's harder. It's a harder thing to do than just a silent speech. You know, tolerating speech is a lot harder.
Absolutely. It takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of patience, because you want to choke the crap out of somebody when they say
the
wrong thing.
I've checked with you, and somehow death loses its sting.
You know, some people say stuff that's so irritating, you're like,
eh. Right. And frankly, had someone tried to choke Chase, then that would have been, you know, then they would have been able to say legally, from a constitutional standpoint, it was disrupting the educational experience, and then they would have had legal constitutional grounds, in my opinion, to make him take off the shirt.
Right. Well, and also, you know, and this leads to, the big thing we've heard about French schools, for example. For example, French schools, they're not allowing any kind of religious emblems at all.
Right.
In
right.
French public schools. Now,
right.
I kind of believe that to some degree that allows for more freedom in, in this way, because nobody is being bullied by the dominant religious group.
Right. And I think that, you know, again, like public schools have a different standard.
Right.
And I would agree. You know, I think there's some good things. Like when kids all wear uniforms to school, there's less sort of arguments about who's cool, who's this, who's that.
Right.
I think it is good to take some of those distinctions away and let kids be kids. But again, you know, in the American school system, that of course wouldn't happen.
Right. Well, and I'm a big fan, by the way, of there being a group of rich, pretty kids who make the rest of us feel like crap. Because without that, I wouldn't have reached the level of success I have in my life, because that's what I've been fighting my whole life. That's, you know, if I wasn't seeking some sort of revenge against Jason Day and Tammy Lilly and all the beautiful rich kids, I wouldn't have ever accomplished anything. I'd be pumping gas right now.
Well, there you go.
Sure.
That's the other side of free expression.
Absolutely. Yes.
You have to work harder.
There you go. You know, it's like that Republican councilwoman who said that, you know, hunger is a great motivator. Why feed kids? You know, it's the same. Yeah. By the way, she's still working there. Anyways,
okay.
So, and from your opinion, obviously you dealt, you came at this because your father was very prominent in specifically freedom of speech.
Yeah, so my father is a civil liberties lawyer who fought a lot of free speech cases, some that are, you know, historic and famous, like the Pentagon Papers he was involved with, and Lenny Bruce, the comedian's, his obscenity trial,
right.
And some that are more obscure. Recently, he represented Don Imus, radio talk show host, I'm sure you're familiar with.
Unfortunately.
Who made a very ugly statement and was terminated. Now, of course, that's not a true issue of First Amendment free speech, because the First Amendment refers to the government. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom
of
speech.
And a corporation can say, no, you can't say that here.
CBS
obviously
could certainly say that.
Well, yeah, if you had a Starbucks employee who was yelling racial epithets, you know, as new names for the drinks as he was handing them out, they would have the right to terminate him.
Right. Of course, the Imus case is complicated because, you know, you hire somebody to be controversial, you just don't, you know, those lines are hard to find.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, with Imus, it was weird because I'm not old enough to remember him, quote unquote, as a shock jock. You know,
right.
That idea. To me, he's always been, you know, kind of he was just the morning why is that guy on the morning news got headphones on?
Right, exactly. Most of my generation don't know him as that. But that case was interesting because it made us sort of think about, you know, what can you and can't you say in America right now?
Sure.
You know, like clearly Don Imus crossed the line for many people, you know, and it just raised an interesting conversation.
Right.
In the film, we deal a lot with Middle Eastern issues. There are a lot of people who say,
you know,
you really can't talk about the Palestinians and Israeli conflict in a way that's at all sympathetic.
That shows
to the
parity. Absolutely. There's definitely that. And you actually had the case of a woman who lost her job for explaining what the word intifada meant.
Yeah, a woman who defined the roots of the word, the Arabic roots of the word intifada,
right.
And didn't just say, oh, the intifada is terrible, you know, just, and that's the only thing she said. She said it means shaking off, which you look it up in the dictionary, and that's
exactly what it means.
Arabic roots.
Right. God forbid we should actually be able to pay attention and know, you know, whatever happened to that know thy enemy kind of idea. Like,
right, exactly.
Please be aware.
Certainly mistaken for a sort of Arab, you know, extremist terrorist that's this, like, you know, boogeyman right now in our country. She was certainly, you know, lumped into that when in fact she has, you know, she had a child who served in the Foreign Service, you know, served at Ground Zero and served in the military. This is exactly the kind of person who helps us build bridges to the people who think that we're terrible and want to kill us.
You know, similarly, I mean, I think this is probably in line and around probably the same time that Bill Maher lost his show for saying that the hijackers, that suicide bombers are not cowards.
Right.
Making just a very distinct choice that it's not a cowardly act. It might be crazy.
Right.
But it's not cowardly.
Right.
You know,
it's not cowardly. Right. It's cowardly. Right.
Is letting somebody else do your dirty work for you. which is the argument that he was making, and that cost him his job.
Yeah, 9/11 is another one of those subjects difficult to talk about.
Absolutely. I mean, the 9/11 truth movement, of course, tiptoes, you know, all over this, you know, especially if they're trying to legitimize the conversation. You know, they have to always go, well, I just think it's not, the information's not all there. I just can't bring it all up.
Well, that's the case of Ward Churchill that we cover in the film, who's a professor who said, you know, he equated the, you know, he made, yes, an offensive statement saying that the people in the towers were like little Eichmanns and basically got what they deserved.
Wow.
That's a very controversial statement. He made it on the blog. He didn't make it in his workplace at the University of Colorado, but the university was able to sort of dig up some stuff that he had done that was irregular during his academic profession, like plagiarism, and they were able to fire him. But still, we have to be worried about this because it's going after people for what they say, you know?
Well, we also, I think, overuse the word controversial. His statement was not controversial. It was jerky. It was something a jerk would say. It was mean. It was cruel. It was dismissive. I don't know that there's a lot of controversy. I think there's a lot of just, shock. You know,
You say something like that.
Yeah.
But I'd say the controversy is that there are some people who feel that there was U.S. policy over the course of decades had been so violent towards many other people in many other countries that we sort of had it coming that somebody would exact violence.
That I think is the definition of a controversial statement, because I think there are arguments both ways on that one. However, just saying that the people who were in the office that day deserved it on behalf of all of us is ridiculous.
Right. Nobody deserves it, whether it's at our hands or anybody else's.
Yeah, even still, it's like saying the people in the federal building in Oklahoma deserved because the CIA carried out MK Ultra. You know, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. These are all victims.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. He's just taking stock innocent victims and assigning blame to them because he has an issue with the government instead of. Yeah, I think the more controversial thing is, why didn't they blow up Congress? You know what I mean? I think that would be the way he's leaning mentally. He just didn't have the guts to say that. He just said something mean about...
Yeah, what would have happened if he had said that?
Right.
I don't know.
He couldn't legally say it. It was probably what it was. So he was able to carry this out. It's a fascinating thing. You know, what are we ranked right now in the world in freedom? I think, 27th or somewhere along those lines?
Is there actually like a list?
Yeah, there is. There's a freedom index that's published every year.
That's news to me. I think you're the first person who told me that.
Oh, it's pretty fascinating. We obviously dropped 10 points during the Bush years, thanks to the Patriot Act and all number of other kind of, you know, the culture muscling freedoms away from people. Even if the government didn't stop you, the people wouldn't let you just be?
Well, it's very depressing because actually our founding fathers were just so brilliant in crafting the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, abridging the freedom of press. That was nowhere. I mean, it's a miracle. It was a pure act of genius. And for us to trample on it is really, it's really shameful because it is the cornerstone of democracy. Without free speech, you can't fight for your rights. And we see that in Iran, right? Those people are on the street. They're exercising their free speech. That's their only way to fight for a government that they find oppressive. So it is the cornerstone of democracy.
Absolutely. We're listening, we're talking with Liz Garvis, by the way. She's part of the documentary for HBO, Shouting Fire, Stories from the Edge of Free Speech. Fascinating topic and a very difficult one for people to deal with, because we have a big shame reflex in this country, you know, where we want to shame people out of saying anything that makes us uncomfortable. There, you know, I personally think that the whole issue over gay rights in this country is that a large group of people are arguing for their right not to feel icky about something they don't like. I mean, it really does boil down to that. I mean, does gay marriage...
Don't ask, don't tell policy sort of, you know, carried to the extreme.
Absolutely. And with DOMA, you know, where you've literally have people going, my marriage means nothing if gay people can get married. Well, that's absurd beyond measure. That's based on how you feel. So how does anything that anyone else does affect the fact that you love your husband or your wife?
Right.
That's
absurd. They need to look at their
own marriage. Right. And this hits right to the key of free speech.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times that's what we're arguing. We're arguing that I don't want to have to hear that. That makes me feel icky. Or I might have to question what I'm thinking if you get to say full voiced what you think.
Right, and free speech is very uncomfortable. I mean, one of the famous cases in the 70s were the Nazis who wanted to march in a Jewish suburb of Chicago.
Right, I remember Skokie.
And, you know, and it's, why choose that Jewish suburb? I mean, it's for the maximum impact. Yet they have the right to do this. I mean, you know, that's very difficult to fight for that right.
Yeah.
Well, but, you know, you have to believe it, because if you, they don't have the right, then the people of Iran shouldn't have that right.
Exactly.
And the people who wanted to do the tea parties and protest Obama don't have it right. And the people who want to protest the Iraq war against Bush then don't
I
have it right.
I will fight for the right for what's left of the Republican Party to teabag themselves all day long. I am for that.
Yeah, they can do that, and so can everybody else. And I think that's, you know, that's why you have to stomach things like the Nazis.
Absolutely. It's that. And I think the people of Skokie handled it perfectly. They all stayed indoors and put ribbons on their doors.
Right.
I mean, they didn't react against it. They just let it die on the vine, which is
exactly
what you should do with hate speech or anything that you don't like.
Right.
Can you stick around we got to go to a break, but I want to talk to you a little bit about hate crime legislation, because this has been turned into a free speech issue, and
mm-hmm.
I don't believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
So hang out for a second. Liz Garbus is with us. This is Hal Sparks. I'm filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEP-12, if you have anything to say about the rights of free speech, or if you have anything to say that might make people uncomfortable, call in, let me bleep you. We'll be right back.
This is wild. I never heard anything like this in my life.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Desperately want to make love to a schoolboy.
Shut up and never say anything again as long as you live.
We are still talking to Emmy Award winner Liz Garbus, who is a part of the HBO documentary Shouting Fire, Stories from the Edge of Free Speech. And what I wanted to talk to you about in this next little block, Liz, in the little time we have left, is about the idea of hate crime legislation.
Very right. Very complicated.
Yes, because it's, you know, a Shouting Fire, actually, you know, you're taking that title from the idea, is it okay to yell fire in a crowded movie house, is the old free speech argument.
Right.
You know, where does...
It's not okay, because it causes imminent crime. I mean, you know, you can't, you know, yell to a crowd of people, you know, an angry mob who, you know, is a KKK mob, oh, we should go kill black people, and think that that's not, you know, that is an incitement to violence.
Exactly.
You know, free speech is not all free. I mean, there are limits on free speech.
Well, you know, when does it become an expression of an idea and an order?
Right, and I think you have to. It's the context in which the speech is uttered. You know, if you say this with people with a, you know, very interesting. The other day there was a case in which a man was arrested. He posted some stuff on the internet saying, you know, these three judges who
Hal Turner, right?
Yeah, who made decisions about gun laws should be killed. And here's their address and here's their phone number.
Right, not unlike what Michael Savage did just recently with people at Media Matters. The only difference is Michael Savage didn't outwardly say they deserve to be killed, whereas this is what Hal Turner did.
Right. So these lines are very different. These lines are very hard. I mean,
right.
Is it his free speech to say that on the web he didn't commit a crime? Well, you know, in this case, I think properly the FBI decided, yes, this was not free speech. This is not protected speech. You know, if he hadn't put their names and addresses out there and he hadn't had a following of people who might be crazy enough to do it, then, you know, then maybe it would be free. But given the context of that particular cry, you know, it's an issue.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, and again, Bill O'Reilly seems to think that this, you know, that any hate crime legislation means you can't be mean, and therefore he would lose his job. Liz Garbus, Emmy Award winning Liz Garbus, Shouting Fire, Stories from the Edge of Free Speech is the documentary. Thank you so much for talking to us today. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Awesome. Coming up in the next little bit, we're going to have the latest on the Michael Jackson discoveries. I mean, there's new information coming out all the time, and hopefully we'll get into a little more gossip stuff, because I would like to deal with Mark Sanford a little bit. I don't want him to get swept under the rug. I think his news is important. So this is Hal Sparks filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEP-12. This is the Stephanie Miller Show. Hal Sparks filling in for Stephanie and the Mooks while they're away on vacation all this week. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. StephanieMiller.com. On the line right now to give us the latest is on Michael Jackson and all things sort of gossipy and entertainment. We have Courtney Hazlett from MSNBC's The Scoop. Courtney, are you with us?
I sure am. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing great. I apologize. I'm at JFK Airport. I'm literally on my way to L.A. to cover this Jackson story. So if there's a little background noise.
Don't complain at all.
I'm
in Los Angeles. We should have you in studio this week while you're here.
That would be fantastic.
If you're still on East Coast time and you're waking up really butt early in the morning.
I will be.
No question. Okay, so a lot of news, not just the 911 phone call coming out this weekend, but the second autopsy results.
The second autopsy results, and I think probably more importantly, the physician has finally given a statement and is his spokesperson is speaking to the press. So we have a lot of new information. If you recall from that 911 call, it was one of the things that became evident immediately was why would someone be doing CPR on a bed who's a doctor who knows how to do CPR, and then you move him to the floor.
Right.
And one of the things this doctor said now was, listen, I actually found Michael Jackson in his bed. He had a faint pulse. And I was trying to do CPR on the bed, but I was doing it with one hand on his chest and the other on his back, so
right,
to make up for it, and then moved him to the floor. He also says that he never gave him Demerol, that, you know,
right,
he had been prescribing drugs, but none of the drugs that you're hearing about in the press. So really it just ended up raising more questions than answering, in my opinion.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, if he had a, first of all, you don't give CPR to someone who has a pulse.
All you'll do is
shock the heart. It's a terrible idea. And the, you know, the 9/11 operator was saying, well, there's a physician on site. Obviously, he sort of outranks me, as it were. So I'm not going to give you any more information. And all you could hear was the doctor just kind of yelling for them to get
it
a paramedic.
It seemed chaotic. It seemed really chaotic.
Yes.
It wasn't the sort of situation where you think to yourself, okay, everything's under control. Another thing that I've learned in the last couple of days reporting this story is it struck me as odd in that 911 call that the person who made the call said there's a gentleman who needs an ambulance.
Right.
There's no, like, it's Michael Jackson, get someone here quickly.
Right.
And I spoke to somebody who's recently signed a confidentiality agreement, you know, as recently as the fall to work with Michael Jackson, said under the terms of his agreement, whether or not it's the same as this person who made the call, but it's safe to draw a parallel, he said under the terms of his agreement, he's not allowed to use Michael Jackson's name unless that person is in the room with Michael Jackson.
Well,
so that's how well trained the people around him are.
Right.
Even during a crisis, they're following the rules.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the handlers he had around him. I mean, like, I read an article in The Guardian UK over the weekend that was sort of laying out the reality behind what was going on in Michael Jackson's life, that he was basically controlled by a former nanny in a lot of ways for a number of years, had the Nation of Islam controlling his security, and then had doctor after doctor just prescribing OxyContin and Demerol to him over the years. And Deepak Chopra was actually on the news this weekend, and really kind of eulogized him very sweetly, but honestly said every time he would see him, it was very obvious to him that he was using OxyContin, hillbilly heroin to the rest of us out there, Rush Limbaugh's drug of choice, a horrible narcotic that is very addictive. And every time he would bring it up to Michael, Michael wouldn't talk to him for 2 or 3 weeks.
Right, and you know, I know some people who were trying to get Michael to agree to a meeting with Deepak Chopra in very recent weeks, and he just wouldn't do it. And you know, whether it's Demerol, whether it's OxyContin, they're all from the same group of very insidious painkillers.
Right.
And you and I both know that it's not just Michael Jackson or Heath Ledger in Hollywood.
Oh, by no means.
Who have issues with this. And you know, if we go to fast forward to the what can we learn from this experience, I hope that this just overprescribes of these really just lethal narcotics, it has to stop.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's clear enabling.
Well, and you know, obviously, you know, Rush Limbaugh's story didn't do it for everyone because he's, you know, survived, but you know, as it were. But now you look at Michael Jackson, he was down to, what, 110 pounds, under 110 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
He was 5'10". They were worried that he was anorexic, and he's on painkillers. There's no way the body can take that kind of abuse.
I mean, let's put it this way. If you or I had just one dose of, let's just say, Demerol, you'd have to pick my head up off the desk.
Absolutely.
To function in the next hour. You know, I mean, like, that, it would knock me out. And I'm not an exceedingly underweight human being. He was rehearsing physically 6, 7, 8 hours per day. The
right.
fact that he was able to still show up, and not just show up, but be present in some sense. AEG has a recording of the show in the can.
Wow.
I mean, so he was present enough that they've got the concert on tape, and it's good enough that they're thinking of marketing it.
Well,
you know, posthumously at some point. So
just to make their investment,
his
right?
His addiction was so severe, and he had such a tolerance, and he'd been enabled for not just this doctor, but probably scores before him.
Well, and also, you know, in this show, by the way, which apparently he thought he was doing, he was only going to do 10 shows, and it became 50. And he even said to his fans at one point, I don't want to do 50. I don't think I can do 50. As he was coming out of a rehearsal hall, he said this,
mm-hmm.
and people were kind of shocked when he said this. But, you know, he was only going to be on stage for 15 minutes out of the whole show. That was his planned, amount
right.
of performance, 15 minutes after, God knows how long the show was going to be, an hour, 2 hours? Who's to say?
I was going to say, I think there'd be a little bit of fan outrage if that's the way it actually did shake out. I do know that there were a lot of, A-list performers who were going to be making appearances at all the shows, and so I do think they were trying to still give the fans something,
well,
on
he was
some
desperate.
Level, but...
Yeah, he was worried about that.
He was worried about it, and, it's... Everybody has wanted a piece of this guy for,
right.
since 1969 when the Jackson 5 came on television. And,
right.
I wrote a column the other day saying, the real tragedy of this story isn't so much his death as it is he never had a life.
Yeah, absolutely.
He never had a chance even to have a life. There have been people wanting a piece of Michael Jackson, whether financially, just his presence, what have you, since he was 11 years old. And,
right.
He can't trust anybody. Even his family members want to screw him. His father beat him. Who do you trust? How do you have any semblance of a lifestyle?
Well, it's, I've
never got a chance.
Right. Well, and I've been saying all along that, as big as his impact is, it is largely boiled down to the fact that he is a classic example of another child star. Tragedy story.
Yep.
Because this is how we deal with child stars largely in the West. It's just what happens. And it's sad that we haven't learned our lesson,
No, we really haven't. We really haven't. And yeah. And then, I always keep bringing this up, too. It's just like you feel so bad for those three kids. I mean, we look at this guy who was, on one level a phenomenon, and then another level became a little bit of a freak show, let's be honest.
A little bit. In all honesty,
it
was...
To someone, it's their father. It's like at the end of the day, it's the father for three kids, and it's just tragic.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking to Courtney Hazlett from MSNBC.com, The Scoop. She's been covering and will be covering, coming out to Los Angeles to cover the Michael Jackson circus, because that's really what this is becoming. Obviously, album sales shot up over the weekend for Michael Jackson. It's been, and this is, I said this, I was doing stand-up all weekend, and truth be told, I was telling some jokes that, it might have been a little too soon, but I think they needed to be dealt with. And,
that's a too soon category.
Yes, exactly. But the point I was trying to make is that all these fans came out in support of him right after his death. And it was a huge outpouring. People were running down to the hospital, the people mm-hmm. that showed up at his court proceedings and stuff, the super fans that he had. And yet the guy couldn't sell records or tour for, the better part of a decade and a half.
It was truly amazing. I was stunned. I was covering, everything as it was unfolding on MSNBC and watching the crowds just get bigger and bigger outside of the UCLA Medical Center when there was nothing to see, Hal. I mean,
right.
there was literally nothing to see, yet more and more people kept coming. I also thought it was interesting that it was virtually on the UCLA campus. A lot of the people in this crowd weren't even born when We Are the World came out.
No.
I was just like thinking of milestones of Michael Jackson. It just shows his reach was so intergenerational.
Well, and
cross
he has,
races.
Right.
It's really a phenomenal level of fame that I'm not sure can actually even be achieved again.
Well, no. I mean, obviously, the record industry has changed fundamentally forever. You don't have the, you know, MTV doesn't even play videos anymore. So
right.
It's, you can't, you know, cut an artist out, even if they were worth it these days, through just the mass, you know, MySpace music dot, you know, is not going
to
ever break an artist the way MTV did with Thriller. It's just not going to happen. So it's in some ways similar to Elvis. You know, Elvis was the breakthrough white artist who basically took black music and
right.
made it acceptable to a wider audience. After that, other people did it, but it never was that first cut.
And when the Jackson 5 came out in 1969, you had the choice of one of three channels to watch.
Yes.
So it's like now, yeah, you might have someone amazing come on, you know, America's Got Talent or Star Search.
But they're going to be lost in the sea of other people.
Yeah, they're lost in 180 other HD channels that you're watching.
Buried under Susan Boyle videos. I totally understand. But, you know, but I think the young generation, you know, they know because Justin Timberlake would talk to no end about what an influence Michael Jackson was on him. And Usher, you know, many people thought was the second coming of Michael Jackson.
Even look at the Lady Gaga video. That's completely influenced by Michael Jackson and Thriller and those group routines and really the spectacle that didn't exist. I mean, Michael Jackson's video for Bad was 18 minutes long.
Right.
And directed by Martin Scorsese. Who does that?
Right, exactly. Especially anymore. It was a short film. I mean, like, what, Blood on the Dance Floor? And then the other one he did, but I even forget the name of it, the one about the haunted house where, you know, he plays a ghoul in it, you know.
Oh,
that was,
right.
I mean,
I love this. Commercial and is the first guy to really, a first musician to really do something that commercial.
Right.
And the last one to not be called a sellout.
Yeah.
I mean, he figured out the game, and you got to give him credit for that. If he seemed dim or out of it on the outside, he certainly knew how to play it on the inside.
Well, the truth is, if your moniker is the King of Pop, you can sell all the soda you want. Because,
right. And let's not forget that the self-proclaimed King of Pop.
Right,
and
exactly.
That's what he came up with on his own. Who does that?
Right. We all remember when he was, I guess he was handing out that award or whatever, where he accepted an award as the greatest entertainer of all time.
Yes.
And this long, rambling monologue, and everyone, oh, no, please,
please.
You know, we're all mad he has handlers who control his every move, and then we're amazed when his handlers don't take care of something like that. It was, you know, the poor guy was a wreck. He was a shell of who he was. He'd been driven into the ground by, you know, a team of horses pulling him in whatever direction they wanted. And it's a classic tragedy.
It really is.
So I would love it, by the way, if you would come out and join us in studio and fill us in, because I know there's going to be more to this story. So if you're going to be out here anyways, I'd love to have you in here talking with us live and going through all this stuff, because it's going to, again, and I think you're right. I think if we can push one thing out of this, is there's no difference between pharmo-narcotics and regular narcotics. And arguably, if there is, street narcotics have been tested on more people.
So true.
You know what
I
mean? Like, the effects of them are widely known.
It's plainly evident that it's bad.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas you can't tiptoe around the fact, like, well, OxyContin, I know it's bad, but it comes from a doctor, so it's okay. The DEA was originally put in place to stop the over-prescription of pharmo-narcotics, including morphine. That was the whole point of the DEA to start with. They didn't even bother with pot at that time. This was a time when the country had lithium in 7-Up and cocaine in Coca-Cola.
Exactly.
You know, we've learned a lot.
The evidence is there. I think we should all have the message loud and clear by now, you would think.
You would think. So, again, hopefully that will be part of this. You know, obviously 6 weeks from now we're going to have the toxicology reports, which will be a whole new story.
A completely new chapter, definitely.
No question. And this will be after his family has fought over where to bury him, if at all.
And money. Don't forget
money.
Oh, man. In 30 days we'll have a will.
Well,
so.
Apparently 200 unpublished songs willed to his children, though. Do you know about that? Have you heard about that?
That's right. I mean, he basically has a completely additional catalog
that that has not been published, so that nobody who he has debts to can have any control over them, because unpublished songs are worth about as much as a doodle.
Thank goodness, because those debts are close to $500 million.
Right, exactly. And his children shouldn't have to shoulder that. They should have something to, you know, to take care of them the rest of their lives.
Precisely.
And hopefully these songs will be precisely that, as long as whoever's warred over them, that's going to be the next big issue.
Exactly.
We'll take care of it. So, Courtney Hazlett, have a great flight.
Thank you.
We look forward, hopefully
see you soon.
Absolutely. No question. Courtney Hazlett from MSNBC.com, The Scoop. We will see you this week. Thank you so much.
Indeed.
Cheers. Yeah. Heavy. The strangeness of this man's life, the only thing that could possibly eclipse it is perhaps the strangeness of his death and the aftermath. This story will just grow in the days ahead. It's going to get stranger. And then, of course, we don't want to forget Billy Mays died over the weekend. The pitch man, Billy Mays, dead at 50, found in his home, unresponsive by his wife. Sweet guy. I got to talk to him a couple of weeks ago. Just a dream to be around and a really good guy. We'll talk a little bit about that, too. You're listening to I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller on the Stephanie Miller Show. 1-800-STEPH-12. And we'll be back right after this.
It's absolutely perfection.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Drop your shorts and bend over, Mr. Babar.
Oh, no, I'm no lawyer, but I do believe that's a violation of my rights.
This is my favorite Michael Jackson song.
I know your every move, so won't you just let me be?
Now, that being said, musically I like it, but I don't get the lyrics at all, because when this song came out, I was like, why would you want a girl to get off of you? But I don't understand why you want her to leave you alone. Now I understand, but then I did not understand where he's coming from. That's the whole chorus. Dirty Diana, no. Come on, Dirty Diana. No means no. It's very strange to me. This is it's an odd song. This and Billie Jean were very confusing songs in my upbringing. This is, songs that a singer wrote about a girl he didn't sleep with. That's a lot of information about something that didn't happen, you know? So, anyways, we have a couple more clips. David Axelrod spoke about President Obama's reaction to the death of Michael Jackson.
The president obviously believes that he was an important and magnificent performer, and obviously he led a sad life in many ways as well. But his impact is undeniable, as you can see on your own airwaves and everywhere. I mean, the reaction has been very, very strong. But the president has written the family and has shared his feelings with the family, and he felt that was the appropriate way to go.
Yeah, that's the thing that that gets lost a lot in this whole conversation, and I thought Courtney brought it up very well, is that this is, above and beyond all this. However, although the oddness about his life or his pop star status, he's still, a brother to an entire family and a father to three. This is such a sad, strange story, and you could see it coming in a lot of ways. Martin Bashir's documentary on Michael Jackson, a lot of us just watched in amazement at just getting this picture on Michael Jackson that we'd never really gotten and weren't even sure if we wanted to some degree, because you sometimes we like this pop veneer, we like not knowing about certain people, in this TMZ's kind of age that we live in. A lot of people do chip away at the fame of other people, but there's a good portion of us that go, you know what, I'm cool if Harrison Ford just wants to be Harrison Ford the rest of the time. And with Michael Jackson, he was kind of one of those figures up until the allegations of child abuse and those things came up. And so, let's hear 17. Let's do it.
11 and 12. I was under contract with Motown, and I would have to go to the recording studio. I had to go and make these albums because the summer tour was right around the corner. And right across the street from the recording studio was a ballpark. And I could hear the kids, the roar of the crowd and playing and catching ball and having fun and playing tennis. And some of those times I so passionately wanted to just go over there and just play a little bit and not go to the recording studio and sing. Just to, have some fun with the kids. And I couldn't.
Wow. I mean, just a, childhood used up, basically. And You know, not to turn this too far to the right, but that's what the right argues a lot for. Is, hey, if you got a profit to be made someplace, you know, dagnabbit, you should be able to do that. You should just be able to take advantage. He's your kid. You know, you should be able to squeeze every penny out of him that you can. It's a very sad thing. And of course, more information will be coming out constantly. This is Hal Sparks. You're listening to The Stephanie Miller Show.
Gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. That's right, Tony. It's okay. We're all new here. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph all this week while she and the Mooks are out on vacation. I hope they're enjoying it. I hope they're not just, you know, listening to the show white-knuckled at home going, no, what are you doing to my baby? It's going to be fine. We are getting through. We're doing a great job so far, I think, if I can pat myself on the back. We got a lot of ground to cover. There's a lot going on in the world. We talked about it on today earlier with Lawrence Korb from the Center for American Progress. We talked to Liz Garbus, Emmy-winning Liz Garbus, about her documentary, Shouting Fire, about free speech. It's going to be on HBO. And, of course, so we just talked to Courtney Hazlett from MSNBC.com, The Scoop, about Michael Jackson and just the soap opera that is opening up after all that. Now, speaking of... you know, I think what I would like to do this hour and take your calls about it as well is get back into the sort of the mix of those things, where pop culture meets the world of politics. Where better than the sex scandal? You know,
You can tell so much about a person from the way they live. Just looking around here, I can tell you're a genuinely dirty person.
Mark Sanford, the governor of South Carolina, of course. If he had waited 2 days to give his apology, to talk about his affair with his Argentinian mistress, Maria, if he just waited 2 days, it would have been the same day that Michael Jackson had passed away, and no one would have heard it. No one would have cared. It would have been buried under a mountain of news. If he'd have just stayed disappeared for a couple more days, I'm sure he's kicking himself if that's his idea of a good time. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. The number here is 1-800-STEPH-12, 1-800-STEPH-12. Now, do you think that sex scandals are relevant? Do you think they're important to the national discourse? I happen to think that they aren't when they pertain to Democrats, and they are when they pertain to Republicans, for a very specific reason. Democrats do not, traditionally, run on family values. They do not run on the idea that they can tell you how to live your life. As a matter of fact, that's why we're the party that largely supports gay rights. I know people are, you know, hoping that Obama follows through on Don't Ask, Don't Tell and DOMA, but we are, at least from my side, the liberal world, the progressive world is really about privacy rights, the Roe v. Wade or in regard to gay rights or just in your own personal freedoms. We don't care. If you have an affair, that's your own business. Our response largely to Clinton was it's not messing with the country. He can do what he wants. But the Republicans took that and ran with it. And took this, you know, has been hitting this country with a moral hammer for years. The idea that they are the most Christ-like, they are the most family-oriented party, they have family values, and therefore they are better, more superior than all of us sleazy, slimy sinners on the left. That we have no right to even exist. We are filthy people. And then bang, one after the other, these guys come out. Larry Craig, you have Sanford himself. You have, of course, have Senator Ensign, who just came out. An unbelievable amount of you know, scandals that come out, again, that wouldn't necessarily be scandals if they hadn't made the point that they were the party of morality to begin with. We've got to call Sam from Providence, Rhode Island, saying that if you're a celebrity, you better behave. Is that what you're saying? Sam, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here, man.
How are you?
I totally agree with you. Yeah, by the way, I loved your work on TV.
Thank you.
But if you're going to tell me how to live my life, you better live your life that way.
Exactly. You know
otherwise, it's what are you just talking about?
That's what
just
makes it news. That's what makes it news, right?
Exactly.
Otherwise, it would just be a personal family matter. As a matter, you know, it's many ways why people overlooked Kennedy's dalliances, as it were. You know,
Kennedy's, Clinton's. It was a personal thing.
Yeah.
They didn't set themselves up as to say, you know, and Sanford, he's sworn that everybody should bail if they fail his personal test.
Right.
What's he doing? He's not doing anything. He's
absolutely
staying on as governor.
I mean, this has been a tradition on the right from Jimmy Swaggart, and I thank you for the call. But, you know, there's this thing that you can just apologize and move on even after you've beaten the crap out of people. Rush Limbaugh, addicted to OxyContin, having his housekeeper buy massive amounts of drugs for him. Just after, you know, a couple of months earlier, he had said that we really, drug addicts deserve no quarter. They don't deserve any kind of leniency. The treatment is not really what it's about. It should just be harsher jail sentences. They push that like crazy. They really run that into the ground that, you know, it's about jail time and not treatment. And then they come out and have the biggest drug problems as well. It's the moralizing that is the ridiculous part. Let's go to Dave in Chicago. Dave, you there?
Hello, Dave. Yeah, it's not the sex scandal that we're so into with the left. It's the hypocrisy
right.
scandal.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
That's all I wanted to drop in.
Thank you. Yes, well, you're absolutely right. They, you know, and this is the people who say that, you know, if you look at Glenn Beck, hey, it's just common sense. We're just telling you the truth. That's all we care about is we just tell you the truth. Well, the truth about Glenn Beck is that he's largely a dry drunk and that he was an alcoholic, and he'll tell you this even sometimes. He was a mean alcoholic. He was cruel to people around him, but he's also comfortable with the idea that the minute it's over, in his mind, it's over. Like, Meghan McCain was on Bill Maher on Real Time, and her big thing was, you know what, I'm just sick of Obama blaming the former administration. And because, you know, he should just move on. That's where MoveOn.org got their name, because after, you know, after the election of 2000, everybody's like, we should just move on. That is the rallying cry of the right whenever they get caught with their pants down, literally and figuratively. Robert, though, in California does not agree with me on this. Robert, you there? Robert, do we have him? Are we there? Nope, we lost Robert. There you are. Is that you, Robert?
Yes, it is. I just wanted to say that to some degree I disagree with you.
Okay.
You know, I think that Mitt Romney talked about this yesterday on Meet the Press.
Right.
That just because somebody screws up in their values and morals doesn't mean we throw the values or the baby out with the bathwater.
Oh, I'm not
you
saying
know,
the I'm not saying the values are wrong at all. As a matter of fact, if that's how you want to stand in life, good for you. I mean, I absolutely think that people have the right to go. I'll give you an example. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't do drugs. I never have. I've never had an alcoholic drink in my life. And I stand by that. And I will stand by that my whole life. That is an area where I think my values have been very clearly staked out. Now,
but why do you do that? Why do you do that? Is that just for you, or do you believe that other people, if they had joined you in that crusade against those substances, would have a better life?
Well, I do think I don't think it's a crusade because I don't obviously this is the first time I've mentioned it on the show.
Right. I just
you know,
chose that word. I just mean don't
sure.
you think others would benefit from your values?
Well, I think they would, but I also think that if I were to reach out, if I was making that my rallying cry, if that was the very distinct thing, if I went, "Hey, I'm Al Sparks, your straight edge radio host for this week on the Stephanie Miller Show," if I made that my rallying cry, there would be more of an impetus for me to follow it than if I just had it for myself.
But there's also what's called redemption. And if this man can heal his family, can heal his marriage, can save the parents of those children that he has and keep them together and then change his ways, then that's the ultimate morality.
On a personal
you guys
level?
You guys want to persecute him.
No,
and
no,
that's
on
immoral.
On a personal level, I think that's absolutely the case. But I'm talking in the general scope of the GOP. The Republican Party they've basically weakened that redemption muscle by overuse. If you look at Newt Gingrich is a fabulous example of that, you know, where they hammer this moralization, and it's not so much that you have these values, is that you use them to be one step above other people. That's the issue I have. And then when you fail,
I want to make sure we don't go down that other road where we throw redemption out. That, you know, that
no question.
People are not redeemable. Well, because Bill Clinton, I think that's one of the greatest qualities about both of the Clintons, is they taught America about redemption.
I totally agree, and I think, and I'm right there with you. But they just seem to throw that out the window, and they use basically as the moral equivalent of a flush toilet. It's not that they actually redeem themselves in behavior and change at all. They just go, well, that was me before, and now I'm not like that. And then they continue that behavior we find out for many, many years after the fact.
I definitely think the lying to where he was, being a governor, people should know how to get a hold of you, where you're at.
Yes.
You know, that he failed on the job.
Right.
It's not that he failed by having an affair, but he definitely failed as a governor.
Yeah, being missing for 5 days. Absolutely. I thank you for the call, and I appreciate the point. We also have Lex in Nebraska. Lex, you there?
Yeah. Hey, Hal,
yeah.
I dig you, baby. You
Thanks.
Are way cool.
All right.
Okay. Here's what I'm going to say about the whole, even if this had happened after Michael Jackson's death and it did not get the full coverage of the press, that, which it did, I think the people in his state still would have definitely have paid attention and would have taken note that their governor thought that it was okay to just be out of communication
right.
for several days. You know, that is a pretty poor judgment on his part.
That's a terrible job. Performance. If you want to just
exactly.
go, yeah, straight on your, the other thing that they will go on is that, you know, the government doesn't know how to do things and private sector does. Well, the government doesn't know how to do things when Republicans are in charge. When you've got a Republican governor, he thinks it's perfectly fine to disappear for 7 days. He planned on disappearing for 10. He only came back early because it became, to his great surprise, a hullabaloo. He was amazed that people cared. He hadn't even turned over the power of his state to his lieutenant governor, which is what you're supposed to do.
Exactly. And it's not as if, like he had a child that was had a terrible situation, was in the hospital, and he didn't get all of his paperwork in order or whatever.
Right.
Like, no, he went to go fool around.
Exactly.
Like, you can't plan ahead for that.
By the way, while his staff was furthering this sort of BS Republican, point that they always make that they're all these cowboy types. Yeah, he's probably he's down there hacking an Appalachian Trail. That's what he's doing. Like, they were literally making up a story to cover the fact that they didn't know where he was. And the story they made up was to further a bigger lie, a bigger falsehood. And, you know, the idea, you know, he just likes hanging out in the South. Yeah, South America. Yeah, the South Pole with his Argentinian mistress. How uncountry is that? I'm just saying. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, I wouldn't rule it out for Toby Keith, but I don't think you're going to find any bluegrass musicians or coal miners who ever went, you know what, if I could just get me a Argentinian mistress, I could settle down in Argentina. You know, down where the Nazis settled after the Second World War. I thank you for the call, Lex. That's awesome. All right, we'll go to, I want to take Larry in Buffalo. Larry, you there?
Yeah. I just disagreed with one caller. I mean, if you can't live up to your own standards, what standards can you live up to?
Exactly. And here's the thing. The ironic part is that they are holding other people to their standards harder than they're holding them to themselves. You know,
Absolutely.
If you look at the Democrats who've been caught in their dalliances, they were either impeached in the case of Clinton, or they stepped down or were forced to resign. Larry Craig is still in office. John Ensign is still in office. David Vitter is still in office. Mark Sanford is still in office. The Republicans never, they use redemption as this reason of like, oh, we'll just forget it. It's over. You know, we don't, I ask for forgiveness, and so I can go back to doing what I was doing 10 minutes ago. It's absurd. So I thank you for the call. That's totally true. Steven thinks it ties to the stimulus. Steven, you there?
Hey, Hal, this is Steven in San Diego. How are you?
I'm great. You mean Sanford's, you're apparently re-entering the atmosphere, I'm assuming, in the space shuttle?
You know what? I just wanted to say about Governor Sanford, I just kind of want to give a quick ha-ha to him, because I remember a couple of months ago, he was refusing to take the stimulus money.
Sure. He got sued by a high school student and forced to take it.
That's the point that I was making, was that portal girl wrote him that impassioned letter saying, basically, my school's falling apart, there's tiles that are leaking, and he basically gave her, like, kind of the middle finger and was like,
right.
This is my political agenda in front of your school. And I sort of feel like, in addition to all the stuff that he said about gay marriage, which, by the way, I'm a gay person who has never cheated on my partners.
Right.
But
you can't possibly – wait, no. Because you're gay. You can't possibly have any kind of a family value. That's not even – there's no way. The gay, quote-unquote, lifestyle is clearly evil, as we've shown with these couples that have been standing on the courthouse steps who've been together for 35 years, who've been faithful to each other and love each other. But that's not the same thing, sir.
Well, it's so funny because somebody like me can do something like – can cure cancer, but yet I'm still diminished by the fact that I'm gay in the eyes of these people. But they can go and cheat on their wife and
right.
then make one apology or be like...
And not show up for work for 5 days or 7 days.
Yeah.
Disappear.
Or be like Ted Haggard and go to like a de-gayification camp for 2 weeks and then all of a sudden...
Right.
Be absolved. It just drives me crazy.
It's absurd. You know, gay is, for the record, not contagious, nor, you know, I personally believe it's inborn. It's there from when you're, you know, and the sooner we come to that conclusion, the cleaner we will be as a society.
Absolutely.
Cheating, however, is a complete choice. you know, it's funny that they go, Sanford had no choice but to cheat. You know, Limbaugh even said that. He was like, he was just overwhelmed. He just, you know, he'd been driven crazy by the stimulus. The country's going to hell. He's like, what the heck? You know, and he had no choice but to go to South America and sleep with someone who wasn't his wife. Yeah, that makes so. But gay is a choice. Sanford has no choice. It's just the way things are. But gay is, it's absurd. Thank you for the call, Stephen. We're going to take a break. This is Hal Sparks. I'm filling in all this week on the Stephanie Miller Show.
This is wild! I never heard anything like this in my life.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Bend over, Mr. Babar.
Check, please.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is a number. We've got a lot of calls on the line talking about these issues. I think the issue of Republican hypocrisy has got to be one of the hammering points. I want you to play a clip. This is Governor Pawlenty of Minnesota, who, by the way, still hasn't made Al Franken a senator, hasn't signed the paperwork, even though it's obviously gone. Anyways, so here's him talking about Governor Sanford.
How much damage has been done nationally by the actions of Governor Sanford and Senator Ensign?
It's hard to quantify that, John, but clearly there's been damage anytime you have leading figures who are engaged in behavior that is sad and troubling and hypocritical. Other people are going to look at that and say, they don't walk the walk. So Sanford was derelict in his duty. He should not have left the state and not allowed people to know how to contact him in case something happened. That's obvious.
Not only do Republicans combine sexual indiscretions with bad job performance, but they also think that immediately afterwards they should be able to wash it away just with a single statement, a couple of apologies, and off we go. It doesn't work that way, and it shouldn't work that way. And I think a lot of people kind of agree with this. Let me go to that was a nice little music sting. Thanks for that there. That was good, Tony. That was all right. I almost jumped into dancing. That's what happens when you play music and I'm around me. We're going to go to Micho in Long Beach. Micho. You there?
I wanted to say yes.
Yeah.
I wanted to say it's funny because I've been hearing this word redemption a lot today, this morning, and it's like they play semantics. See, because when you look at the word redemption, there's also the word redeem or something that's redeemable or redeeming yourself. But the Republicans seem to say, oh, I'm sorry. But then they don't change. They don't do
absolutely
nothing different.
Absolutely. That's the fact. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your call.
Like
this is the Stephanie Miller Show. We'll be right back.
I was going to expose you.
I know. So I choose to expose myself.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie and the Mooks all week while they're away on vacation. Thanks for tuning in. You can check out the podcast at stephaniemiller.com. We have a lot of calls to get to. I want to get to a couple of quotes, though. This is one of my favorite ones. This is my former home state. I grew up in Kentucky. This is Mitch McConnell.
What is your reaction, Senator, to the developments in South Carolina with Governor Mark Sanford?
Look, we're working on health care and the people's business, and that's what we're doing in the Senate.
This is the second prominent Republican to announce an affair in as many weeks, with Nevada Senator John Ensign coming out. What does this mean for your party?
Brett, I think the important thing for us to do for the American people is the business we were elected to do.
Yeah, like showing up for work. How about that? I'm just going to throw that out there. Let's, sex scandal aside, let's put it point to the fact that he didn't show up for work for 7 days straight, and he was planning on not showing up for 10 days. And God knows what time he was wasting while he was doing it over the last year having the affair. So, all right. Now, this is just Mitch McConnell dodging the fact that this is a real problem for them, for what's left of the Republican Party. By the way, I don't actually believe the Republican Party exists anymore. I'm kind of talking about them kind of like I talk about pterodactyls, because they really don't agree. They got 26% approval rating, and fewer people recognizing themselves as Republicans. I think if we're going to have a true two-party system, and maybe it's time for the Libertarians and the Greens to stand up. What kind of political discourse would we be having right now if it was the Dems versus the Greens on real issues? Can you imagine? And then we could finally sweep out the Blue Dogs, and that would be great. Okay, so we've got a lot of calls on here. Ken actually thinks that Sanford's problem is that he won't shut up.
Hey, Hal, it's Ken. How are you?
I'm great.
Excellent. Yeah. Oh, my God. He is the gift that Sanford is the comedy gold gift that keeps on giving, isn't he?
Well, it's just like apology after apology. Like, okay, who else can I apologize to on camera? He apologized to his whole staff. Did you see that?
Yeah. You know, I did see that. But the one thing that really cracked me up was he only cried when he was talking about his, like, man friend. You know,
yeah. I'm really let down.
Not hurting his kids or his wife or anything like that. Just, you know, his buddy. Oh, my buddy.
Well, I know. Why would he cry about that? Because he left his kids on fire. Father's Day.
Exactly.
And his wife had kicked him out a week before.
It was just so disingenuous. And at one point in that press conference, too, he started crying, and they started asking him questions. He was like, no, wait. And then he starts crying again.
Right. He wanted to squeak out every tear he could get.
It was pretty good. But, hey, great job on the show today.
Thank you.
But, yeah, there's another video of him out, too. They caught him in a car with one of his buddies driving down to, I don't know, Buford or something like that.
Oh,
and
sweet.
And he says that he understands that why they want him, people would want him to resign, but he just, you know, quoted the Bible and said, and you know, he needs to walk humbly.
Oh, that's sweet. Did he bother to quote the Bible where it says he should be stoned for adultery? Any of that part? Does that, how about coveting thy neighbor's wife? Any of that? Nope.
No mention of that at
all. He's not really quoting those passages so much.
No.
Thanks so much for the call, Ken. It's stunning to me. I mean, like, you know, that's the thing. If it was one guy, I mean, basically the Dems have had, you know, two major guys. We've had Spitzer and Clinton. These are our two biggies, you know. But, I mean, from Larry Craig to Ensign to Sanford to, like, every 10 minutes it seems like something else is going on. Even Lindsey Graham was saying, well, I have some dark things in my past that I don't want to come out. And I'm like, I don't want them to come out either, because I don't even know how to know what they are. I mean, if he's as crazy in his relationship as he is about policy, I mean, it probably involves farm implements. I'm just saying, he's a weird dude. But let's go to Andrew. Andrew in Northampton, Mass.
I want to say that Governor Sanford should apologize. I mean, he apologized to everyone in his state and even to someone in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
If the Republicans want to keep their values and not lose them to hypocrisy, Sanford and Sons and all of them should apologize to the people they've demonized to build their own political career.
Right.
That's what they should stand up and say, gosh, I'm sorry that I said that Bill Clinton was a horrible person.
Right. Oh, that's not going to happen, though. You do recognize that. Because that mean.
Oh, I can dream.
Yes, I know. But, they, you know, they're worried that we will do to Bill Clinton what they did to Ronald Reagan. You know, they're trying to just chip away at any legacy that he has. That was the whole point of that.
There's another thing, that Republicans use morality and Democratic moral scandals to attack the political agenda of Democrats, as in, you forgot John Edwards, all of a sudden poverty doesn't matter because John Edwards got caught in a hotel.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they used that to sweep that entire issue away. I appreciate the call, Andrew. That's absolutely the case. You know, Larry in Jacksonville, Florida, makes a good point, too. Larry?
Hello?
Hey, Larry, how are you?
Yes, sir. You're talking about the morality and the Democrats and all and
right.
the Republicans. Well, it seems awful strange to me that a Democrat gets caught in the White House or in the Oval Office having old blue petted.
Uh-huh.
But yet when a man like Bush signs off on legislation and paperwork that sends our young kids to be murdered in a useless lie.
Right.
I think that's pretty sad.
No question. I mean, I think one of my biggest problems. Yeah. Right. Right. Well, one of my biggest problems with the GOP, you know, and their hypocrisy. The biggest issue for me is that you have a group that almost everything they do, almost every issue that they carry. And I thank you for the call. Almost every issue that they carry. They actually follow a contradictory path. They are pro-lifers who believe in the death penalty, war, and don't believe in universal health care. How do you sustain that in your own brain? How do you not go crazy and have affairs and how do you not flip out in those situations? Because every day you walk around the halls of power, you are living a lie. You know, you don't believe a word you're saying. You're just selling it. And you're going to see that in the energy bill with the, you know, they're pushing, you know, back against the climate bill as it goes into the Senate. And they're just going to push it straight on as a cap and trade issue. And they're going to say, well, global warming doesn't even exist. Well, I got news for you. I believe global warming exists, and so do most of the sane scientists in the world. But here's another point. Even if it doesn't, we all know that the burning of fossil fuels is polluting, and it sends more children to the hospital with asthma attacks every year. Hundreds of thousands of children go to the hospital because of pollution-oriented asthma attacks and shortens their lives. If you really care about kids and you're all pro-life, why do you not care about moving us to an electrical grid style of transportation? Why is that not important to you? If the health of children matters, why doesn't that matter to you? I'll tell you why. Because you don't really care. Because you're in the pockets of the big industries. And David thinks that their hypocrisy should be hammered as well. David, you're in Washington?
Yeah. Oh, my God. You're hitting on all cylinders. Everything you're saying. Anyways, let's see. Henry Hyde, remember he was chairing the House Judiciary Committee when they were trying to impeach Clinton?
Right.
He was having an affair, too.
Right. Newt Gingrich was actually having an affair with the woman he's now married to during that period.
So the hypocrisy, just when you think the Republicans and some of the Democrats scrape the bottom of the barrel, they just keep getting, they just keep finding deeper layers.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. You know, the interesting thing is that they don't, and I'd be interested on what you think about this, is that I think it really is a matter of what you state as your morals as a politician or as a public figure. This is how I am, this is how I live, and this is how I believe other people should live. Then if you don't live up to those standards, you're out.
Not only that, but notice how Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich, I mean, you just line them all up like the Stooges, all trying to score these cheap political points the last month or two, claiming, oh, I'm not going to take the stimulus money when they have to take it. It's not even
absolutely.
Their decision.
Well, you got to understand. And again, thank you for the call. I'm going to let you go because it's a little bit noisy. You know, these guys are also arguing against education funding. They basically, you know, Grover Norquist came out, big conservative voice, said, I think it was in the early 90s, the goal is to shrink government to the size that you can drown it in a bathtub. That's their dream. Okay, so of course they want public schools to fail and public health care to not happen and the army to be underfunded and most of it to be put out to people like Blackwater and to have people like KBR and Halliburton doing the electrical work, which the army used to do for themselves, doing the electrical work, and then our soldiers are getting electrocuted. And then when you come to them and you go, hey, what the hell's going on? You're giving these no-bid contracts to these people, and our soldiers are being killed by it, and you don't care. But they still want to ride this moral horse, you know, moral steed into there. Anyway, so, okay, let's take Chris in Madison, Wisconsin. Chris, you there? It's all right. It's okay. You're on the air.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much for what you do to create dialogue and that really supports our system of government.
Absolutely.
So my my opinion has to do with the fact that, and I really agree with your point on hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
And your basic supposition, though, is that there's a difference between Democrats and Republicans relative to infidelity.
Right.
And I think what it comes down to really is a matter of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the question is there a real separation between personal and public life in terms of trust?
Right.
And to me, I don't think there really is. And I know that one of the sociological aspects of trust is that it takes a long time to regain it once it's been broken.
So I think that's true, but I think the trust should be based on what I say, based on, you know, how I live. If I don't ever bring up, you know, the fact that I don't drink or do drugs. Okay, if I don't ever bring that out as a public issue, which I do, but if I didn't say that, then the fact that I fell off the wagon or something at one point wouldn't be anybody's business. It wouldn't be a breach of trust with the public that I serve. It would be my own issue, much like the question of Obama smoking, let's say. But if I literally hedge all my bets on moral issues, such as this, and then I fall off, then the breach of trust between me and the public is way bigger. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree that it's bigger, and I think you need to look at the base of what the values are, and those, you know, in this culture, they predominantly come from a Western religious background, and we are all basically living by those same, you know, rules of trust. So whether they're stated or not, it's certainly more hypocritical if they are stated.
Well, again, I do think that, you know, I think you're right. I think we do base it on that. I think also, however, though, that modern Christianity, as it's practiced in the United States, has turned into the moral equivalent of a flush toilet. People figure that Sunday, everything from the last week is wiped away, and they don't actually have to do any penance on it. They don't actually have to make amends for what they've done. So an apology is enough. People, literally, Sanford is treating the American public like a sinner treats God when they're praying away their sin, and that's not enough to me, I think.
Yeah.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yep.
And
so back to the question of whether or not it makes a difference, whether it's there's a difference between personal or public. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think as long as it's a personal dalliance and you work it out with your family, I think that's a very personal issue. If it doesn't affect your job, then, you know, then it is by no means any of my business. The question is, how much do you think it affects your job? Obviously, if you're running if a bill like the Defense of Marriage Act, where gays are not allowed to be married, is very important to you, then you think that everybody's sleeping with is going to be your issue. But I don't. I think, and I'm against that particular rule, so I think people should have the right. So that's where we have just a difference of opinion. It's not a difference on morality. And the truth is, anytime you make a law based on a moral idea, not stealing, not murder, not things that affect another person permanently, anytime you take a moral and you make a law out of it, you diminish the capacity of that moral action. Because, you know, if a guy, and this is a stronger example, but if a guy is standing there and he wants to kill someone, but the only reason he doesn't kill someone is because there's a cop within, visual distance, he's not acting morally. He's just acting because he knows he will get caught. You know, that's not a moral decision he's making. He's making a legal decision. He's protecting himself. And so these, you know, obviously Sanford was acting the way that he thought he could get away with it because he was the governor, because he was in a position of power. He thought there was no one who could see him do it. He could get away with it, and it was no one's business. And it went so far as to limit his ability to do his job. And this is a huge thing. Now, granted, I think the Republicans don't want the government. I don't think they want it to exist. I think they are closet anarchists and Ayn Randians who don't know what the value of collective bargaining is. But I want to thank you for your call. We have to get onto some more. But I really appreciate the discussion. I really do. So, you know, this is a big issue. And I do think it is a dividing line between the right and the left. I think it is one of the most distinct differences between the progressives in this country and the conservatives in this country. The conservatives, I don't think actually exist anymore. I think there's probably six of them still working and living in the United States someplace, but they're not being listened to by the GOP at all. They're being brushed aside. And I think the people leading the GOP are pretending to be conservative. They are, in the case of Rush Limbaugh, they are drug addicts. And in the case of people like Sanford. They are morally, let's just say they have a loose moral standard. But they are living under this pretense of the exact opposite, whereas Democrats are like, look, people are people. Humans are humans. This is a big tent. And if you have a dalliance, we can deal with it. But don't try to sell anybody on how to live. That's what I would appreciate or whatever. Dave in Massachusetts. Dave, you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
It's good to hear you.
Thanks. It's good to be heard.
I disagree with you a little bit. I think conservatives are going to be around for a long time.
I do too, but I don't think in the in the form that they are now. I think this kind of weird quasi-religious theocratic group that's running things, that'll fade away.
They have an outsized media presence, and they've got big mouths.
Right.
But
that's a corporatist group. That's less than conservative.
That kind of goes to my point. The point I wanted to make was that the one thing you've got to give conservatives credit for is that they know how to circle the wagons and they know how to cover for each other.
Right. Well, there is a bit of a circular firing squad going on. We have a bunch of clips of that I'd like to play in a little bit before we run out of time. I'm almost to the end of my first show. It's fantastic. Where, you know, you've got people like, you know, Mitch McConnell won't even talk about it. Because he knows there's nothing good to say. You know, Jake Knotts. Let's play the clip from Jake Knotts, number 14. He's not happy.
We got a governor that is out of control. And we need to make sure that the people of South Carolina is protected and their pocketbooks are protected.
Right. And there's your old-fashioned kind of conservative. And I think to some degree... you're right that a certain conservative idea should exist. However, I don't actually believe it's, you know, it's certainly not in control of the Republican Party right now. And I don't even think it's really welcome. And I don't even think they know what it is. It has been so bent out of shape since the Reagan era, because Reagan took what would be a genuine conservative movement and turned it into a corporatist movement. It is strictly about business and taking your hands off business, allowing business to do whatever it wants. Let factory farms produce as much waste as they want, and don't charge them for treating it, even though one factory farm creates more waste than New York City. They don't have to treat it before they put it into the groundwater, and just let them get away with it, and then they don't have to pass any costs along to the consumer. And then you don't realize, oh, well, regular local farms actually can charge less for food than a factory farm if you really factored that in. That's my issue with it. I thank you for the call. We got to take a break. This is Hal Sparks. I'm guest hosting on the Stephanie Miller Show. 1-800-STEP-12. Call in. Obviously, this is a hot button issue. We've only got a few minutes left, but I'd love to hear from you. And we'll be right back after this.
You commie homo-loving sons of guns.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
You figured, oh, here's a loser, you know, a deadbeat.
Well, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Hal Sparks filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're on vacation at the end of my first day. Not too bad. We managed to hold it together. Tony, you almost deafened me on that one 30-second cue, but that's nothing to be ashamed of. Tony, my homie, working the board, doing a fantastic job. And, of course, Rebecca, Shake Your Moneymaker Baker, who's fantastic, basically making sure that I don't do horribly, horribly bad. So big thanks to them for helping me out. Big news breaking right now. The judge giving Madoff 150 years. Fantastic. 150 years. It's like a year for every billion he stole from someone, or 3 years. Yeah, 3 years for every billion he's accused of stealing. He said, I cannot offer any excuse for my behavior. I made a terrible mistake. Okay, wasn't a mistake. You committed a crime. So when he's saying that, psychologically, what he's saying is not. It has nothing to do with the crime he committed. It's I made a terrible mistake by getting caught. That's what he means. People psychologically will tell you exactly what's going on with him. So 150 years, his wife apparently gets to keep $2.5 million. Aww. She had to give up her stake in $80 million. He had to forfeit $170 billion with a B in assets. She's stuck with $2.5 million. What is she ever going to do? I mean, she can't feed her cats on that. I mean, that's crazy. Big show tomorrow. We're going to talk about why Republicans want to kill health care for everyone. Yes, the march of the pro-lifers who want children to get sick and stay that way. We'll deal with that tomorrow. Also, more MJ News will be coming out. Thank you guys so much, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is Hal Sparks filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show.